didn't mean you have to give up. You can live many different lives in your one life as you.
Samson's Pizza by Adam Horovitz. Read by Steve Buscemi. I joined Beastie Boys in 1983. John Berry wasn't into it anymore, so he quit. To me, he always felt a little cooler and more mature than us. He had friends with names like Danny Vegas, hung out at different places with different people, and you could tell that the hardcore scene was not his, how do you say, milieu. And so he moved on.
For John Berry, it was kind of like the joke was over and he wasn't laughing anymore. Like when you fall asleep to an episode of Three's Company and wake up like, why was I ever watching this? Hardcore seemed kind of serious and limiting to John. He was branching out, going from listening to punk and post-punk to folk and American roots and blues music, and a whole hardcore formula and attitude, I think, seemed kind of childish to John. He wanted to go to Polish bars and listen to Ramblin' Jack Elliott while we were at a CB's hardcore matinee being all straight edge.
At this point, I was hanging out with Mike and Adam and Kate all the time, and so I guess since I was standing there, I was the new guitar player. My band, The Young and the Useless, had run its course, and the joke at the time was that I was being called up to the big league from the minors. When I joined, we would have band practice at Yauch's house. It was a beautiful old brownstone on a nice, quiet street in Brooklyn Heights. We kept all of our equipment up in Adam's room on the top floor. Like I said, the house was beautiful, but old, as in really creaky wood floors and stairs from the 1800s. After every show we played, we'd have to get everything back to Brooklyn and lug it all up to Adam's room and do it without making a sound because his parents were asleep in their bedroom, which was right below his. Really, there's no way to be silent and carry guitars and amps and drums and cymbals up flights of creaky stairs, especially when being carried by a bunch of dumb, loud teenagers who think they're doing a great job of being quiet and really truly believe that Yauch's parents are asleep. But we never heard a shut the fuck up from the second floor. Maybe Noel and Francis Yauch are just the heaviest sleepers of all sleepers ever. More probably, they're just wonderful parents. You know those people who tell you that they did all kinds of elaborate and crazy shit? The more details they give you, the more you know they're just making it up as they're telling you. Yauch was not one of those people. One of the first times I went over to his house, we were up in his room, and he told me the story of how, when he was a kid, he and his friend Brian blew up the backyard. The story involved a ton of firecrackers that had been used to make a sort of bomb to blow up the wooden fence that separated the Yauch's yard from the neighbors. Because, you know, kids often wonder, can I blow that up? He said that when he was maybe 12, he had one of those Wile E. Coyote TNT detonator push-a-bar into a box explosion things. Adam's parents can testify to the actual realness of this. It is a fact, he had one. Where and how does a 12-year-old get a detonator? So Adam and Brian attached some kind of wires to the 12-year-old's makeshift bomb and put it on the fence. They had the wires go through the yard, up the back of the house, into the window of Adam's bedroom, and connected it to the Wile E. Coyote detonator box. Deep breath. They pushed the bar down, and fucking boom! They did it. It actually worked. They blew up the fence. The thing that's awesome about being a kid is that there's never a bigger picture. There's so many can I's, like, can I blow up this fence? But rarely a what happens after. What would happen if I actually did blow up this fence? Ramifications aren't really part of a 12-year-old's lexicon. Even Adam Yauch, who always seemed to be three steps ahead, didn't think of the important peripherals to this detonation. I mean, his parents were home. They would hear an explosion in their backyard, so naturally they'd run out there to see what the hell had just happened. They'd see the wires that led from the blown-up fence went through the yard and up the side of the house and directly into their son's bedroom. Now, that is some dumb shit. There'd always be some tasty leftovers in Yauch's fridge. And so sometimes after band practice in Adam's room, we'd sit around the dining room table downstairs and eat. Samson the dog would be down there, below the table, waiting for fallen scraps and snacks. My main memory of Samson is the pizza incident. I wasn't there when it happened, but after Yauch told me the story, every time I saw that dog, I pictured it. And even now, I see random golden retrievers on the street and think of the Samson pizza incident. One night when no one was looking, Samson stole a whole pizza off the table. Right out of the box. Adam and his parents chased the poor dog around the kitchen and dining room area trying to get the pizza from him. But Samson was like, fuck it. This shit is mine. He knew that if he stopped running or put the pizza down, it'd be over. So he just ran around dragging a whole pizza from his mouth, trying to eat it all as fast as he could while in motion. Now, in case you've forgotten, dogs don't have hands. They're not like marathon runners who can get handed cups of water while they continue on their way. Dogs can't do that. Put yourself in poor Samson's place and imagine Adam Yauch and his mom and dad chasing you around the room trying to get an entire pizza out of your mouth while you're trying to eat it without using your hands. After a minute, the pizza fell apart and landed on the floor, but Samson managed to hold on to one last slice. He kept running while he chewed, head up, nose held toward the sky, proud and ashamed, but determined. The visual. Imagine how you'd look if you tried to chew water. Yauch said that in that moment, Samson reverted back to a wolf. He stopped running and dropped the slice of pizza on the floor. He stood hovering over it and let out a protective growl. The Yauch family backed off and let Samson get his slice. I mean, come on. Family is family, right?
Fun fact. Yauch said that when Samson would climb up the front stoop of the house, he'd cut a fart with each step he took. Pause on that for a moment.
A7 by Michael Diamond, read by John Stewart. We needed gigs. So Yauch and I got a little package together with the demo we had made on 100th Street, some stickers and a photo. Kind of played it off like, yeah, we play shows. Look at this one we got coming up. You could say we made up for whatever we lacked in skill and experience with hustle and ambition, the ethos of hardcore in a nutshell. And our little act of false bravado worked. We landed a weekend slot at New York City's only real hardcore room, A7. A7 was on the ground floor of a tenement building at the corner of Avenue A and 7th Street, across the street from Tompkins Square Park. I have no idea what the folks who lived upstairs could have thought. But I guess that's just how shit was on the Lower East Side then, before noise complaints or quality of life offenses.
The then versus now is difficult to put into perspective. We were literally kids, on our own. There was all kinds of booze and drugs going in and out of those places, and no proud parents mouthing the words to the songs from the back of the room. No minivan drop-off, see-you-laters. Who was the adult that told the 14-year-old kid, okay, we got 6 other bands playing tonight, you gotta be on stage at midnight? Where were our guardians? There was never a conversation between any of us kids and our parents where our parents were like, oh, you have a gig tonight? On a Tuesday? Oh, that's cool. Oh, wait, don't you have school tomorrow?
Pretty much every New York hardcore band got its start at A7. Reagan Youth had played their first show there. Kraut, Adrenaline OD, Agnostic Front, the MOB, even worse. And 100 other bands of disaffected teenagers all played their first shows in this dingy ground floor space. Playing A7 was like setting up in your friend's living room. Your friend's small living room. The club was actually smaller than John Barry's loft. Couches lined the walls and a low, small stage sat in one corner. The audience wasn't really separate from the performers. We were all part of this house party. So we got there, set up, and just started playing. When things got going, the crowd of 12 or so people would use the couches to launch off of, sort of stage diving into the room like many a suburban youth would later do in their garage. Our performance was neither triumph nor disaster. We made it through. Mission accomplished. And another late night train or cab ride home. We had played a real show.
The Young and the Useless had our first official gig at A7 too. We got on stage, got ready to play our few songs to the very few people / friends that were there. Maybe 10 people, maybe. My friend Dave Skilkin, the singer, was really nervous. We counted the song off. 1, 2, 3. And as we're about to play our very first song at our very first professional gig, two of our friends jumped on stage and tackled little Dave Skilkin right before he's about to start singing. It was actually the greatest way to be initiated into the world of performance, with your friends on top of you.
Our next show was opening for Reagan Youth at Trudy Heller's in November 1981. There are a few dozen people in the audience and not just our small group of friends, and that made me feel way less embarrassed and self-conscious. I looked out once we started playing, and people were into it, starting to mosh, jump around, crash into each other. This was pretty exciting. You didn't really know what you were doing, and it was all kind of a goof anyway. John had been kind of skeptical about the whole thing, but there was a moment when Yauk and he looked at each other and probably thought, holy shit, people seem to be into this. Top it all off toward the end of our shows, all of a sudden I see fucking Bad Brain singer HR join the crowd, moshing around, into it. That was crazy. I mean, we loved and revered Bad Brain so much. And here was HR actually into us. Even crazier, backstage afterwards, HR comes in and he says hi. And then very quietly and humbly asks if we would like to open a show for them the next month at Max's Kansas City. The final show at the club, which was closing the next day. What? A legendary band shutting down a legendary venue, and we get to play too. 3 months after our first fucking show. We went from goofing around, throwing some hardcore songs together up at 100th Street, to playing these shows with people that we totally looked up to and respected. Insane. Playing Max's Kansas City was intimidating. For a couple reasons. One, because of how we perceived it historically, with the punk history and lineage from the Velvet Underground to the Ramones to Devo to now. And two, the guys who worked there were these big biker-looking guys, and we were little skinny kids, and the overall vibe was of a harder, older crowd of drugs and booze. We were actually very innocent for it all. It felt scary and menacing. I don't think we really processed why. Came on first, only played 3 songs, and our performance sucked. At the Trudy Howler show, the audience's energy had been contagious, and we fed off of that. At Max's, the audience never seemed to lock in or care. And we responded in kind. To cap things off, we were so young and inexperienced, read dumb, that we left our equipment there overnight so we could pick it up the next day, only to discover when we returned that most of it had been stolen. So, yeah, that sucked too. But the momentum of those 2 shows mattered. Over the next year, we played tons of shows with a host of other esteemed colleagues, old and new, Bad Brains, Misfits, Reagan Youth, Swans, Sonic Youth, Necros, The Stimulators, Live Skull. After a while, there's only so much of a rush you can get from, say, playing a hardcore matinee at a bar that smells like stale beer, urine, and cigarettes. But it felt like we were a real band, playing real shows, with a real hardcore 7-inch, and maybe even a few fans. And then something happened that made us throw away everything we'd already built. Hip-hop came downtown.
Hip-Hop Goes Downtown by Michael Diamond, read by Rosie Perez. Our parents lived all over the city, but we were downtown kids. Record store shopping, club hanging, show going, handstand forging, downtown kids. A pack of teenagers, girls and boys, going out to clubs practically every night. The drinking age in New York was 18 and never enforced. You could be 13 and get into a club, no problem. If you were tall enough to see over the bar, you could get a drink. Originally, we'd go to clubs to see shows by bands we loved. At some point, we started going more just to dance and to hear the new music that DJs would play. Clubs like Danceteria, Area, or the Mud Club had DJs who spun every kind of music imaginable. They started playing rap, particularly Grandmaster Flash's The Adventures of Grandmaster Flash on the Wheels of Steel, Treacherous Threes, Body Rock, the Sugar Hill Gang Records, Curtis Blow's The Breaks, and Jimmy Spice's Adventures of Super Rhyme. Harlem and the Bronx was closer to my parents' apartment than the downtown clubs, but I would have been way too intimidated to go to Harlem World to witness the culture where it began. Instead, the culture came to us. rap groups and DJs from Harlem and the Bronx started to perform downtown. One night at the Rock Lounge, much to our excitement, Funky Four plus One More performed. Not only had we never seen a rap group in person, I don't remember having seen any on video or TV either. Rap was still underground, with the exception of Blondie's homage, Rapture. That night at Rock Lounge, we had this real geek anticipation of seeing the show, same as we would for a class concert at the Palladium, and Funky Four delivered. Little Rodney C and Chi-Rock were both incredible MCs. If you've never heard their single, that's the joint. You should put this book down right now and listen to that shit because it's incredible. The band's routines, the fast switching between their vocals and the mix of their voices was so magical, they killed it. We left the club that night feeling high, like we'd seen and heard and danced to something entirely new. The real turning point for us was when we started going to this club on 2nd Avenue in the East Village called Negril. Negril was a reggae club, but they started having a hip-hop night on Thursdays. The first time we went, the DJs were Afrika Bambaataa and Jazzy J with the rock steady crew dancing. Everyone rolled thick with posses. So you had this crowded little club that was a convergence of cultures, a funny and amazing blend of downtown characters, hip-hop pioneers, and curious musicians. I remember seeing Terry Hall from The Specials, the English DJ Don Letts, and Billy Idol in the mix. We were just still kids, and these guys were big stars to us, people we'd only seen on the cover of The Face magazine and NME. Add in the Rocksteady crew and everyone that Bambaataa brought from the Bronx, and we were seriously intimidated. Nothing could prepare us for Afrika Bambaataa. To us, club DJs were people who played single records and maybe made sure the beats matched between songs so that everyone kept dancing to the disco sound. Bam was doing something entirely different. He was the first guy we seen who took small parts of a bunch of different records and mixed them together into an entirely new song, one that he made his own. He was an insane combination of curator, improviser, and musician, a true breakbeat DJ. It's common today, but at the time, we'd never seen or heard anything like it. Even more revolutionary to us was the breadth of music he'd play. He might start with a seamless mixing of breakbeat b-boy classics, but then he'd throw in everything from Gary Numan's Films to Aerosmith's Walk This Way to Tony Basil's Mickey, from Michael Jackson to Kraftwerk to Yellow Magic Orchestra to Soul Sonic Force. To Bambaataa, it didn't matter what the group looked like or what they were about, just what a record or a groove sounded like and what he could do with it. The breadth of his DJ sets is still unparalleled. I think our brains short-circuited. It had never occurred to us that so much music from so many different worlds could all live together, with the sum being far greater than the parts. Bam also had DJ Jazzy J in tow, and J was a next-level vinyl manipulator. Again, we innocent teenagers had never witnessed such finesse. Quick vinyl scratches, super fast crossfade moves, beat juggling, beat matching, taking parts of a song and repeating them, manipulating two copies going back and forth, cutting in or mixing a sound, a vocal line, or a horn stab to create something totally new. Bam was like a master orchestra conductor, Jazzy J, his main musician, and the sounds and beats and words and melodies of crates and crates of records were the notes of their symphony. The shit was crazy, so good, and so well done. Our world was forever changed. I don't know how any of us got to sleep that night. Maybe we were just wrung out from dancing. We couldn't wait until the next week. Any other club night now seemed a bit less exciting. We'd seen the future and wanted more of it. The next week we went, and it was the same crazy mix of characters, but the club was noticeably more packed. And this time, a group performed. The Treacherous Three. If there was one rap group we loved at the time, it was the Treacherous Three. We studied and tried our best to memorize every single word and every rhyme on the 12-inch records they had out. Body Rock was an anthem. We loved that shit so much. And here they were, on stage, in a tiny club, just a few feet away, performing the songs that we couldn't get enough of. We get something new. We get something new. They were fucking great. If you've never heard Body Rock or the new rap language, you should once again put this book down right now, find them online, and listen to those shits because they are fucking incredible. We rapped along with every lyric and stood amazed when they went off into routines and freestyles we never heard before. Their voices and styles were varied and still formed one amazing whole. The second week at Rock Lounge was even better than the first. Rap, in all its far-reaching ambition, was now it. Our hardcore punk world simply couldn't compete anymore. How much louder and faster and woolier could bands get? So much of hardcore is about limits. Shorter, simpler, more speed, more volume, whereas breakbeats and hip-hop are all about the limitless. Limitless possibilities. Limitless imagination. Punk rock had changed our lives, but hardcore has served its purpose. Now, all we wanted was to be our own version of the Treacherous Three. No turning back.
White Boy Bouillabaisse, An Archaeology, by Blake and Jonathan Lethem, read by Bobby Cannavale. It is a white man's world, they say. No sane white man would dispute it. But it wasn't the white boy's city. Not in those days. And as William Carlos Williams correctly forecast, the pure products of New York City in the 1970s go crazy Eddie. Which is actually a good thing. To go crazy Eddie is to pick up the material of the sidewalks, the vibrant sarcasm and hostility of the street encounter, and to sell it as your own, to make it your preemptive shield for navigating the zone. Crazy Eddie might be the very first white rapper, after all. To invite him aboard is to take on the homeopathic dose of urban madness, the inoculation. You ingest a little eyedropper of Crazy Eddie, wear punk nerd apocalypse on your sleeve in order to keep from locking it too hard in your heart. The city is writing the rules. The A-train is already in screeching motion, and you? You're just reading the map, or trying to, through the layers of dripping tags and the scratchiti. Try to keep a sense of humor about the situation. When you gaze into this polyglot stew, the polyglot stew gazes into you. Zoom in on three specimens yanked from the mad camouflage of their environs, plopped instead into the petri dish of a Quaker summer camp in the woods of Pennsylvania just weeks after the July 1977 blackout, Summer of Sam. This is Friends with a capital F, as in the religious society of, you know, the guy on the oatmeal box. Camp Onus, based on the Quaker principle of simplicity. A largely no-frills outpost, hippie counselors in tie-dye, campers sleeping in double bunks in huge open-sided army surplus tents pitched on rough wooden platforms. The place was commonly mocked as Camp One Horse, though there were in reality zero horses. Or Camp Onus, where the responsibility for having fun is on you. Few facilities, but for a city kid just getting out of Brooklyn for 4 weeks of the summer, Camp One Ass could save your life. Standard uniform here might be Lacoste and Keds, worn in homely preppy sincerity, or a black concert tee and ripped jean jacket, if you wanted to suggest you were capable of cutting a class and hanging out in the park. The jean jacket could be painted with a Zeppelin if you had the skills. If not, alter your high-top Chuck Taylors by scribbling those pretzeled Led Zepp symbols or the Who's Bullseye logo with a blue ballpoint. Hold up. Destroy a perfectly good pair of white high-top Chuck Taylors? Not these three lads. their caucasoid as the next man, but these guys come from the tribe that keeps a toothbrush in their back pocket in order to keep their suede proc heads looking fresh. Who knew when you would get another pair? Some degree of street recognition has come over these three. Here, west of the Delaware Water Gap, standing on a dusty baseball diamond in the woods, Brooklyn's in the house. In fact, the three boys had more in common than they knew. Kings County smartasses with Jewish mothers and Goyim dads. Spoiler alert, only one of this troika's a future Beastie Boy. Let's not trouble yet over which. Just hover at a middle distance and catch a hint of what they're saying. Yo, yo, you got a tag? Let me see what you write. Man, where'd you find this kid? Why are you hanging out with a dude from the kid's tent? What's your name, kid? I'm calling him Yo-Yo. He's cool, man. He's okay. I just never heard a white kid say yo before. You got a tag? You can write? Sure I got a tag. What do you listen to? I don't know. The Jackson 5, whatever's on the radio? You heard of Ramones? Beat on the Brat? Who's a Ramones? Never mind. What's your tag? Show me your tag, or is that pilot just for show? Where? You got a black book? What's a black book? Find a wall. The Camp Onus boys' bathrooms and showers were housed in a concrete and cinder block structure, the walls of which constituted the only decent substrate for miles around. Being correspondingly the only knucklehead for miles around, the kid with the marker, Yo-Yo, tagged with as much style and flourish as his young hand could muster, the others looking over his shoulder and egging him on. He'll be trying to no avail to buff his own tag the next morning, smearing it around with a cloth and an ever-widening swirl of ink and turpentine, two fuming counselors over his shoulder. In mercy, let's zoom out. One of these guys, the tall one, writes the tag Sake, though he's smart enough not to do it here. A Flatbush kid, terrific at basketball, in fact, the only white kid to start for the legendary Riverside Church squad. He'd go on to manage third base, then later to produce Nas's Illmatic. And Yo-Yo? He'd be named by none other than Rolling Stone magazine as the first white rapper. The earliest reported entry on a timeline culminating at the time of the article in question in Eminem. But it's the third, kid named Yauk, who's a nascent beastie. So this was what? Some kind of precognitive summit meeting? Could the birthplace of white rap, for whatever that term's worth, be the Pennsylvania woods, a Quaker summer camp? Or are we just looking at three white boys, momentarily to be sprung from this sanctuary, dumped back in Ed Koch's cauldron? Cut back to the city, where, weirdly enough, this remains a Quaker story. The Religious Society of Friends has run a private school in downtown Brooklyn since just after the Civil War, Brooklyn Friends School, K-12. Though a Quaker institution, BFS doesn't really stress religious training. The student body is diverse, weighted heavily Jewish, like the more expensive and desirable Brooklyn Episcopal private school, St. Anne's, a few blocks off in Brooklyn Heights. But what difference a few blocks can make? St. Anne's is situated in the impregnable Heights on the preferred side of Court Street, a neighborhood tree-shady and placid, adjunct to Manhattan and navigable for white boys of nearly any stripe. Brooklyn Friends, on the other hand, is stranded on cul-de-sac Pearl Street, in the thick of Brooklyn's ancestral downtown. Here's Fulton Street, a ghetto-lively black and Hispanic corridor of wig shops, dress shops, pizza slice, and Jamaican meat patty joints. Its sidewalks, an open-air flea market of knockoff and black market mercantile activity, the possibility of shadiness of a decidedly non-tree variety. Fulton, just before it meets Flatbush Avenue and Junior's famous cheesecake restaurant, is anchored by the buzzing hive of record stores, sneaker shops, and self-styling sociological potentialities known as the Albee Square Mall. The truth is brutal, your grandma's kugel. Kings County is my stomping ground, Albee Square Mall, Brooklyn, downtown. Downtown Brooklyn's a zone that's for safety's sake, non-white boy indicated, though its allure can hardly be overlooked. Any white boy in that particular time-space vicinity can attest to individual indices of attraction fear coping to private mental route schemes mapped to avoid, say, the Hoyt-Schemerhorn subway station or to skirt the corner of Willoughby and J Streets. All three of our Camp Onus boys are destined to pass through Brooklyn Friends School. The special mix of 1970s granola pacifist philosophy-drenched youngsters sent out to run the downtown Brooklyn gauntlet against a backdrop of the vivid, violent, vibrant collapse of New York City's social and material infrastructure might be a machine for producing white rappers. Or, at the very least, let's consent that it is a machine for producing teenage ironists of a deep and uncanny variety. One of our camp owners' boys has taken the full course, writing graffiti, fabricating markers out of felt chalkboard erasers, and writing MC rhymes. Taken with a side order of Chiba and malt liquor, these activities leave school studies a distant contender for last place. Unathletic, white boys being largely unpicked for anybody's team anyway, and certainly not a dancer. The hustle, the bus stop, and the bump had given way to the freak, the Patty Duke, and the rock, all beyond his capacities even to attempt. And as for fighting, well, he'd most definitely proven he could take an ass-whipping many times over. Giving one back, however, was a skill eluding him. But he had the gift of gab. Could spit some fly shit. His slick tongue had been winning snap battles, ranking sessions, and Yo Mama ciphers since third grade. Seated on the stoop with his best friend Alonzo, he would listen to horrible-sounding bootleg 12th-generation dub cassettes of live MC battles and Zulu Nation jams from Alonzo's cousin who lived uptown. The white boy and his black friend memorized and mimicked every routine, the L Brothers and the Furious Five, as well as local MCs with names unrecorded in any ledger. Soon, these two are part of a crew, but in the big yard of IS-293, they're hardly the big dogs. The white boy rhymes on the humble and chooses to stick and move before the real hard rocks show up. By now, Sugar Hill has dropped Rapper's Delight, and the game is changed. Overnight, every kid is an MC or a DJ, and even those not owning a single record, let alone equipment, begin calling themselves DJ Master Willy Will. Just being able to rhyme doesn't guarantee you a pass anymore. Everybody rhymes, and winning a battle easily leads to getting jumped and robbed. Hell, just daring to wear your sneakers with the laces wide and untied gets you confronted. A word? What, you think you hard, homeboy? Yo, you ain't hard, you soft! The white boy in question, formerly known as Yo-Yo, is garbed in burgundy twill Lee jeans with sharp creases all the way up the legs and a burgundy Le Tigre polo shirt buttoned all the way up. The laces in his Puma Clydes match his shirt and pants. Best not be in the wrong place at the wrong time. More white boys for you to consider. This one's flipped as hard in the punk direction as the other's gone b-boy. Arrived at Edward R. Murrow High School, he's taken the first option to acquire the snap-on studded dog collar necklace and painted his leather jacket with the words White Riot. Not actually a phrase destined to play so well on the sidewalk, and he gets himself quickly stomped for it by a trio of homies. How to explain British punk, anarchy, the working-class solidarity of it all? A misunderstanding. Yet who can command the context of the street? But at night, in Manhattan, at Seabees or the Mud Club, or just on a stoop on St. Mark's, the context claims itself. Approving glances from kids mobbing around in the same garb, and you found your tribe for a minute. Maybe much more than a minute. Another white boy is first to form a band, or an earshot anyhow, he seems the first. His reward with his bandmates is to be declared royalty. In those days, the fresh and barely competent are gigging within minutes of finding a rehearsal space, opening for punk legends at Max's Kansas City, and then allowed to hang in the back room with dregs of the Warhol scene. Or maybe not even dregs. The new scene barely laid over the top of the former, and ready to begin taking its photograph immediately. Turning schoolmates into a fan club, the Speedies are so famous, they're already a breakfast cereal. Another band, Upper West Siders, LaGuardia High School of Music and Art Boys, a four-piece of three brothers and their friend B. Sloan on his handcrafted electric bass, devote themselves to funk and soul harmony, develop a little charisma. Their stage act worked around the littlest brother, drummer Michael, who sings in a voice not yet changed Michael Jackson sort of way. Miller, Miller, Miller and Sloan, who opened for The Clash at Bond's Casino and were scouted by Rick Rubin in his early canvassing for a white rap band to mold. The brothers told them they were unwilling to jettison their bassist in favor of canned beats. They'd quickly carved out a place as the white teenage funk band most likely to succeed. No small accomplishment at music and art. A hotbed of talent, convergence from all boroughs. Mackie Jason was there, a great graffiti writer, as well as the drummer who would help create the New York hardcore sound. The Kangol crew, which included Slick Rick and Dana Dane. Also, the fresh three MCs, coming along behind in the M&A freshman class were MC Search and David Shady Skilkin, later in a certain punk band called, right, The Young and the Useless. The kid once briefly nicknamed Yo-Yo, the unfortunate nickname doesn't actually persist, is instead quickly layered behind dozens of assumed identities, graffiti, and rap monikers, after being shifted by a worried parent from public school to Brooklyn Friends, falls in again with the tall one, the basketballer. He manages to convince his friend that disco was not dead, but had morphed into something harder and funkier. Spoonie G, the Crash Crew, Curtis Blow, Super Rhyme, the Treacherous Three were all in heavy rotation. Though he doesn't play himself, Yo-Yo joins the b-ball squad. Clinton, Kenny, Bernard, and a dude named Kegel. Yo-Yo spits one of his little Grandmaster Kaz-inspired rhymes for Kegel in the gym locker room, and right there, Kegel suggests they link up after and go to his crib, just across Flatbush Extension, back behind the Williamsburg Savings Bank. Kegel's a DJ, and the house is a treasure trove of musical wonders. Not only turntables, mixer, and a mic, and wild stacks of vinyl, but a piano and gold records on the wall. Oh yeah, my mom's Betty Carter. Yo-Yo's too abashed to say he doesn't know who that is, but he sure does recognize the name Ray Charles next to hers on the gold plaque. Here's another white boy who, having flunked out, really he'd never even attended classes at all, so there was nothing to flunk from, is placed instead in an alternative high school, one based on an internship model with the insanely appropriate name City as School. Hey, the city certainly has been schooling you, so why not get some official credit for it? City as School reveals itself as another nexus for like-minded teenage heretics, a superb breeding ground for punk bands. Another white boy's more retiring and bookish, the future book writer with the world's largest target painted on his back, such that parents advise their sons not even to walk down the street with him. One cruel dad even nicknames him Muggable Mike, yet he'd quietly tabulate his yokings, years later turning them into his signature motif, his street credential. A version of Crazy Eddie as Long Con, taking what the street gives you and wearing it as your perverse badge. So many others. The Park Slope filmmaker with the novelist dad and the film critic mom. And here, by the way, is another key to the self-morphings of these white boys. So many with one or both parents, the painter, the playwright, the poets and set designers, mostly not famous or even close to making it, but with the capacity to impart the suggestion. To set an example for making your confusion into culture, making something for show, putting on a show. The novelist who'd go on to wear his multiplicitous yokings like gold stars, in the same book he'd portray a gathering of white punk boys leaping around a couch in delirious japing wonder at the energy and idiocy coming off a newly acquired 12-inch Sugar Hill label first pressing of Rapper's Delight. You recognize the sound. You let it into your body, and you held it, at mocking arm's length at the same time. The special cognitive dissonance of the white boy possessed by culture not possessable by him. When the needle dropped on Cookie Puss, it was that same moment, distilled to vinyl. Beastie Boys had shouted back at the sound that had invaded their nervous systems. Tom Carvel, the ice cream merchant turned pitch man, was another Crazy Eddie, his idiotic pitch like some sonic mercantile graffiti thrown up everywhere you went. A white boy in Clinton Hills, originator of the riddle, how does Tom Carvel take a shit? The punchline being not verbal, but instead to squat and mime squeezing out a dump in a long, soft-serve swirl as if into a cake cone toilet. Yo-Yo's first time hearing Cookie Puss was when it was thrown into a DJ's mix, the Zulu Beats show on WHBI late night. The track was weird, seemed to be poking fun at hip-hop, but Yo-Yo and his crew rocked with it anyway. By this time, Mel Brooks and Rodney Dangerfield both had rap records out, and then there was Sean Brown's Rappin' Duke, with a black dude doing his best to sound white. Hell, as far as the larger universe was concerned, every rap jam that hit the radio was Flying Purple People Eater, or The Streak, a novelty hit. There still weren't that many actual hip-hop records on wax. If you wanted to rock a mega mix for hours, everything went in there. Why begrudge some local punks your age their turn at the mic? Next couple of years, Yo-Yo saw the Beasties at various clubs and parties or hanging downtown with some of his boys. He heard a few little singles they dropped here and there, but nothing really made noise until early 1986. The Latin Quarter nightclub was crazy. A small venue packed with all the hip-hop stars of the day, as well as the most notorious drug dealers and stick-up kids of the five boroughs. There was no VIP section or separate, secured, roped-off areas. Everyone was equal. You'd witness robberies, slashings, and even shootouts inside. Crooklyn terrorized the dance floor, snatching gold chains at will. Yo-Yo was cool with the worst offenders from Fort Greene and Lafayette Gardens. He never had any problems there, though he could count the white boys he saw there on one hand. MC Search was the only other Caucasoid you could consider a regular. So it stood out the night a white kid ran in straight up to the DJ booth with a record in his hand. Yo-Yo was talking with Biz Markie and his boy Romeo when DJ Red Alert put the needle on that record. Hold it now, hold it now, hold it now, hit it, hit it, hit it, hit it, Yo Leroy! And then that beat. The reaction was immediate. The hardest hard rocks were on the floor wilding. Everybody was doing the WAP. There were always a couple of records that made Brooklyn get real stupid. The first few notes would signal it was time to form, like Voltron and go Rambo. Records like Cutmaster DC's Brooklyn's in the House, Stetsasonic's Go Stetsa Part 1, and Audio 2's Top Billin'. These songs were audio malt liquor. They could make you want to smack your own mama. The Beasties automatically joined this pantheon of riot starters. They knew how to incite a crowd. Yo-Yo himself, more graffiti writer than MC in the end, he'd dissolve into legend. In truth, the Beasties had accidentally made the first gangster rap album. It's not too wild a claim. If gangster rap is identifiable by first-person crime narrative, misogyny, drug and alcohol glorification, and over-the-top violence, then they had done it for sure. A few stray singles one could point to first, notably Schoolie D out of Philly. But in New York, dudes were not claiming to be criminals on records. Quite the opposite, in fact. Hip-hop was aspirational. MCs wished to be seen as suave and debonair. Lovers, not muggers. Ricky D said, "Calling me a thief, don't even try it." And Dr. Ice of UTFO rhymed, "Me? The doc? A hood? A rock? Running around the street robbing people on the block? Nah, that's not my style. To crime, I'm not related. As far as I'm concerned, I'm too sophisticated." The only real crime rhyme you heard out of New York was in third person and cautionary. The don't do it type of tale exemplified by Melly Mel and Duke Booty. The reason wasn't exotic. Most cats in New York City actually lived in harsh conditions and hoped to elevate above. Live in the hood, avoid cops and robbers, just get in your front door, and you didn't dream crime. You dreamed limousines and fly parties. In New York, it was understood that the Beasties weren't serious. They weren't shooting piano players any more than the Ramones had actually beat on brats with baseball bats. Outside of New York, it wasn't always so clear if they got the joke, in which kids from the right side of the tracks glorified the fouler aspects of ghetto living. Rick Rubin grasped the trick of shocking suburban parents and getting banned from venues in Middle America, a marketing plan modeled on Alice Cooper and the Sex Pistols more than Afrika Bambaataa or the Cold Crush Brothers. That was the intention. Gangster rap was the unintended consequence. Out west, License to Ill blasted from every car driving by with the booming system. In the invention of L.A. rap, you could hear the influence. Some cats even adapted Mike D's trademark nasal whine. Ice-T admitted that Six in the Morning, originally a B-side, intentionally had a Beastie Boys-type sound. And the Bay Area? Forget about it. Sir Mix-a-Lot's Posse on Broadway is essentially a Paul Revere cover. Back one last time to Brooklyn Friends School. Was it just the peculiarity of the locale, the contrast to the code of pacifism taught there, or was there something uncanny in that school's role as playa in some of the most unnerving and violent incidents stalking the white boy mind? Two kids corralled from Fulton Street in what might seem another trite shakedown for pocket money, instead subjected to torture and rape. A parent murdered in her sleep in a renovated brownstone. Other tales might be unknown, private wounds, humiliations tended behind closed doors. Penny ante traffickers and nostalgia advertised Bloomberg's gleaming city as fallen from some 90s peak of danger and excitement, but if you knew the 70s, you're unimpressed. The city was already gentrified in the 90s. The 70s was serious. The world we knew was something else, no matter how tired you might be by now of the testimony of aging white boys. For all the gory fun and provocation, all the John Carpenter horror lurking in sticking up old ladies with the handgun or the sawed-off, in the impostures of the white boy lay a seed of real fear. On this, we must insist. It was the Beastie Boys' special legacy as theatrical pretenders, juvenile actors playing juvenile delinquents that freed them to tell of what they knew in the form of giddy cartoons, to indulge in code-switching of the Mad Magazine variety. That they had an exit option, their whiteness, that is, meant they could dabble, and their dabbling was their genius. You can read plenty on the relationship between Islam and hip-hop, Judaism and hip-hop, even Buddhism and hip-hop, but did the nonviolent philosophies of the Quaker religion have a part in the creation of some of the most violent music ever recorded? Hey, Richard Nixon, another Quaker product, was also known to drop some bombs. Rest in peace, Dave Shady Skilkin, Eve Side Brewer, Adam Bard Yauch, Betty Carter, Ellen Field, Edward R. Murrow, and Richard Tricky Dick Nixon.
The Making of Cookie Puss by Adam Horovitz. Read by Chloe 70. It's tough for New York City kids to like or love anything. It's just not cool. Whatever you do, you have to show the outward appearance of, yeah, pizza's okay. You know, it tastes good, but like, I was eating pizza since back in the day, so whatever. Admiration is from a kind of a distance when you're a teenage child of artsy-type divorced parents from Manhattan. The idea behind our song Cookie Puss was that we were making fun of Malcolm McLaren's song Buffalo Gals. That song was massive in our circle and scene. The clubs of New York City downtown, 83. We actually loved that song and listened to it every day and danced to it every night. Why make fun of it? We had to. Adam Yauch's parents had an old friend, Doug Pomeroy, who ran a recording studio in Manhattan called Celebration, a name I have only grown to appreciate in this very moment. Celebration was a studio for recording jingles for commercials and stuff, a real grown-up place of business. As a favor to his old friends, the Yauchs, Doug Pomeroy would let their son's band come in and he'd record us after hours for a couple nights, for free.
Actually, I had to bring an envelope of cash, like $200 to pay somebody, I don't know, the night janitor or something.
So we recorded all the new songs we had in like 20 minutes. But he'd said we could use the studio for two nights, so we were going to make the most of it. As we listened to these new songs we had just recorded, we realized that they were pretty bad. They weren't hardcore songs. They were oddly goth-ish and just sort of, well, pretty bad. We had a song called Bucket of Cheese. We did a cover of the Cockney Reject song Subculture because Yauch loved that song. We had a kind of love song, Ode to Samson the Dog, in the style of a song that Mike, Kate, and I loved called King of Kings by a band called The Pack. The semi-goth lane was not our comfort zone, and we kind of knew in the moment that the songs were bad. But since we had more time in the studio, we were going to make something. In the early 80s, there were these TV commercials for an ice cream place called Carvel. More specifically, for a specialty cake they made called Cookie Puss. The voiceover was this weird, high-pitched space alien saying, "Hello, my name is Cookie Puss," followed by a slurring man's raspy voice talking about the merits of the cake and the establishment. Allegedly, the voice was that of Mr. Tom Carvel himself. The ads were super cheap and seemed homemade, and we loved them. Kind of obsessed with them, really. Why was Cookie Puss a space alien? For St. Patrick's Day, they'd take a Cookie Puss cake, add a little green frosting on top, and have an ad for a different cake named Cookie Opus. On Father's Day, they'd make Fudgy the Whale. It was a cake decorated to look like a whale using the same Cookie Puss cake mold, and they'd write "To a Whale of a Dad" on it. For Christmas, they'd put a Santa hat on Cookie Puss and have a new ad for that. The cakes and commercials were so cockamamie and grimy and unprofessional that I guess we were just drawn to their punkness. So since we had this extra time in the recording studio, let's make fun of our current two most favorite things, Cookie Puss and Buffalo Gals, and write a song about them. We made a track that was basically just Kate playing a danceable beat, Yauch playing a simple distorted bass line, and we added some shitty attempts at scratching records on top of that. I don't know whose idea it was to call Carvel and curse out the person on the phone, but I was the one to make the call. We recorded it, and that was our song. It's actually pretty fucked up. Sadly, when you're a teenager, you don't think about those things too much. You know, other people's feelings. Like the telephone operator and the woman working at Carvel that I called and harassed and screamed at. Can I formally apologize right here and now? I'm sorry. There's a definite line between funny prank call and being mean. Just randomly calling and cursing a woman out on the phone is not cool. But Adam, Mike, Kate, and I thought it was funny at the time. We were just so psyched to be a band in a recording studio. We were teenagers with a ton of teenage energy. As you get older, you form a filter for what's a great idea and what's not. And so most of the dumb shit falls by the wayside, which is probably for the best. But as I said, we thought it was funny at the time. We made another song that night called Beastie Revolution. Basically, it's just us making a goofball reggae song. We love dub reggae, and so we had to make fun of it not to appear infatuated. We scrapped the other songs we'd written and recorded and decided to release a 12-inch single of Cookie Puss with Beastie Revolution as the B-side on Rat Cage Records. And for whatever reason, people liked it. Our friends started to tell us that they heard DJs playing Cookie Puss in clubs. Mark Kamens or Anita Sarko was playing it at Danceteria. Johnny Dinell at Area. Allegedly, Afrika Bambaataa was playing Cookie Puss at the Roxy. I meant to say Roxy's. If you're from New York, you always leave off the superfluous words and add an apostrophe S after the name of a place. Like if you're going to Carnegie Deli, for instance, you'd say that you were going to Carnegie's, or to Roxy's instead of the Roxy. Things were changing for us now. We were becoming a hardcore band that wasn't a hardcore band. Now we had an actual 12-inch record like the bands, singers, or rappers that we loved. Not like we were huge or anything, but other people besides our 15 friends had heard this song. Going out to clubs was suddenly different now. It wasn't just that we were receiving more attention, but we were a little older, too. Hanging out had a new and added meaning. Meaning, sex. Just a year before, we were out of clubs and shows to see bands and hang out with other kids, maybe flirt a little. Making out was a huge deal. But now it was on and poppin'. The transformation from kid to little grown-up person. That thing when you break off from your friends at the end of the night. Now when we said goodbye, we weren't going home to bed. Now we were looking for a potentially illicit and grown-up goodnight. Leaving the group with someone else. Now that was great. Being young and getting it on. But I digress. One night this kid comes over to me in Danceteria's second floor stairwell and starts to talk to me about Cookie Puss. He says that his uncle is Tom Carvel, and that we don't need to worry about any legal issues, because he'll talk to his uncle about it, and tell him that we're cool, and that it'd be cool, and all that. I was 16, and professional legal issues weren't really on my radar yet. Also, it's not illegal to write a song about a cake, is it? But as it turned out, the slurry, raspy voice from the TV commercials really was the kid's uncle. And he was cool with our song about his product. How nice is that? There's no real point to me telling you this detail, other than that being fantastic that there was an actual, for real Tom Carvel, and that somewhere in his brain, Beastie Boys exists. Right in there next to Cookie Puss, Cookie Opus, and Fudgy the Whale. P.S. Cookie Puss is fucking delicious.
Please Eat Me, The Oral History of Cookie Puss by Colson Whitehead. Al Comey, Busboy, Mud Club.
Say what you want about Cookie Puss, he was one chill motherfucker.
Jane Trilling, Coat Checker, Irving Plaza.
Cookie never talked about his childhood. I know he was from the Midwest, a town called Carvel. A lot of small minds to him talk of it. They used to make fun of him because he was mixed. What are you? Are you ice cream or are you cake? Stuff like that.
Daisy Meeks, cashier, Canal Jeans.
Might as well have been from outer space. He was so far out.
Gary Deluxe, personality.
New York is always too expensive. And people always keep coming. No matter when you come, you've already missed it. Cookie Puss was one of these seekers.
Dev Trimmers, drummer, Shoot the Hostages.
I'm not trying to make a case for New York City from 81 to 85. It's a magical wonderland. I mean, it was no Cleveland 77. But let's just say that New York between 81 and 85 was a great place to be young and to make music.
Angie Dust, DJ, WNYU's new afternoon show.
I didn't get Cookie Puss at first. Still don't.
Bob Plotnick, owner, Bleaker Bob's Records.
Sure, he worked here. I let him sleep in the back sometimes when he was between things. He swept up. Wasn't that good at it. I don't know if it was laziness or what. You'd see him just standing there staring at the LPs on the wall. Staring like an idiot. Last straw was when I caught him holding a copy of Metallic KO up to his ear. I was like, what the hell are you doing? He just smiled.
Chase, Chaz, Chaserton, Projectionist, The Pyramid Club.
He claimed he could listen to vinyl without a turntable. That it was easy once you got the hang of it.
It got so I had to steer him through the East Village, avoiding certain blocks, because he'd have to stop wherever people were selling their shit on the street. LPs, clothes, porno mags. Who'd want to buy someone else's used porno mags? What, Cookie? He'd have to stop whenever he saw some freak selling records. Merengue, polka, funk, he didn't care.
Florian Good, college rock buyer, Tower Records.
He was a bit of a hustler.
Greil Marcus, critic.
He told me he knew someone who was selling Bob Dylan's jockstrap. You know, from the basement tapes. Of course I was interested. We met at the Holiday Cocktail Lounge. Anyway, he rooked me. I mean, does this smell like Bob Dylan's jockstrap to you?
He was a mix, a mutt. When you look at him, you saw what you wanted to see. From one angle, a cake. From another, ice cream. Chocolate, vanilla, whatever you taste, black, white, a cookie puss.
Nothing he liked more than watching TV. Watching TV and sniffing glue. Video Music Box, Ed Norton, Ted Knight, Mr. Ed. You know Ted Knight is up to some kinky shit when he's off the air, he'd say.
You got all types of people in this city. That's what makes it unique. You got your blacks, your Puerto Ricans, Italians, and Jews. Ice cream cakes. Each one an instrument in the symphony of the city.
Madge Fellows, bartender, Palladium.
He still owes me $10.
Giza Benz, bassist, Shoot the Hostages.
At the time, he was dating Lydia Lunch's dermatologist. I don't know how she got tickets, but the Germs were playing on Saturday Night Live. Belushi was a fan. You know, things like that actually happened in this city. Anyway, they tore the place up. His girlfriend was appalled. She was this uptight, Scarsdale-type, skinny little thing. Cookie loved it. He used to say, this is just punk energy waiting to be transformed into something else.
Gloria Meadow, Lydia Lunch's dermatologist.
We came from different worlds. I was the suburban white girl from outside Philly. He was an ice cream cake. We tried. But sometimes love just isn't enough.
You make a personality out of everything you suck into your orbit. Parents, friends, teachers, songs, TV shows, movies, your neighborhood. You know, all that stuff. You mix it together. It becomes your identity. That's the best music. The stuff that makes the new connections between everything that everyone else is putting out.
Grace Graceless, tchotchke wrangler, Love Saves the Day.
We met at a Clash show. Bonds, when Grandmaster Flash opened for them. Stuff like that actually used to happen.
Riff Randall, publicist, Lollapalooza, 1993 to 96.
You didn't want to get Cookie started on the Clash. Obviously, middle period Clash, or else you'd be up all night. Rap, rockabilly, gospel, dub. He had this theory that Sandinista was actually a quadruple album and that the fourth record was lying in a vault somewhere. That they would release it when the world was ready. They started out as a punk band, and then something beautiful happened.
He was a sweet guy. Maybe too sweet.
Evan Parker, dentist.
I heard he came up with the drum beat for Strafe Set It Off, but I'm not sure if that's true.
He's running around with Basquiat, tagging up the city. You see his handiwork all over. CP, for Cookie Puss. But the thing was, he used chocolate syrup, squirting. Next time it rained, it would just wash away.
He'd start raving whenever World Destruction came on, that African Bambaataa Johnny Rotten song. This is the future of music, big beats and guitars. Where punk was transformed by rap music, or rap music was transformed by punk energy, or maybe it was not one thing acting on the other, but the two things just coming together into something new. He thought all music would be like that one day.
Needless to say, it didn't happen that way, but the vibes were out there if you picked up on them.
Paz Trow.